evening. My name is Chris Powis, and welcome to Radio Evergreen. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was born on the 27th of January, 1756, and died on the 5th of December, 1791. History books tell us that he was a genius. But tonight's guest has researched the subject for over 20 years and has a very different story. So welcome, Robert Newman.
Thank you very much. This is Robert Newman. Hello there, Chris. Thank you very much for inviting me on your show to talk about a great subject, a tremendous subject of one of the great cultural icons of Western civilization, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. And I hope that it will be of interest and maybe even will stimulate some people to investigate these things, the importance of one of the great composers, supposedly, of Western civilization. And if I may, I'd like to start by giving a brief outline of where I'm coming from and what it is that I would like to lay out over the course of this interview.
Yeah, sure. I mean, okay. Up until recently, I thought that Mozart was a genius, and I went along with what I was told.
Yes.
But it's surprising. I mean, I think that our listeners are going to be absolutely gobsmacked by what you have to say tonight. So we've certainly got a program for you tonight.
Okay. Let's say your listeners are in polite company at a cocktail party or after a concert, and the subject comes around to the immortal Mozart. If the subject comes around to the immortal Mozart, may I suggest, for the benefit of your listeners, that any study worthy of the name, whether it's geology, geography, genetics, politics, whatever, which of us doesn't profit by hearing at least another side of the story? And so musicology, or rather the history of music, or of musical achievement, is no different from any other study. So although the things I may say are highly controversial, or they may seem highly controversial, judge them, I hope you'll judge them by the documentary evidence. And speaking of that, the documentary evidence, I will have to shoot myself in the foot, in a way, by telling you the truth from the very beginning, that Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart is the best documented composer in the whole history of Western music, bar none.
Why is that?
Why? Well, his music has attracted such adulation, such respect, and some of his music is the finest music of Western music itself. There's absolutely, I don't doubt that one bit at all. So it's supported by libraries of biographies, and then there are the technical journals that musicians and musicologists like to study. There are thousands of these. There are several international studies of study centers of Mozart. So what I'd like to lay out first is the scale of the subject we're just about to discuss. The best documented, the most popular, the most highly rated, the most revered, the most eulogized composer in the entire history of Western music. Now, if that's not enough, Chris, if that's not enough, I will support this by saying that in terms of his life span, that is, 1756 to 1791, the same Mozart is the best documented composer who has ever lived in Western musical history. So here we have a double combination. We have the posthumous writing of huge biographies and great study, which continues to this day. And we also have a literal mountain of documentary evidence in support of the life and career of the same Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. So let me not understate the case I want to tell you straight, honestly, from the very start, that this is the mountain, or this is the, what shall we call this? This is the icon that we are just about to examine. Yeah?
Am I right in saying that, like with most things, it sounds like I'm changing the subject, but I'm not, but like World War II, you've got the official version and what exactly happened. And they're two different things.
Exactly.
And I take it that Mozart, was he, putting it in a nutshell, the Spice Girls of his day?
Mozart was rather like the William Shakespeare of literature. The biographical facts surrounding Mozart do not add up, have never added up, and they never will add up. But the Mozart myth succeeds because it's divided really into two parts. The two parts are as follows. One is the part which deals with his life, 1756 to 1791, and then there's a second part. But you're really not aware of this. This is the posthumous Mozart that we know about from biographies, written after his death over the decades of the early decades of the 19th century, when Mozart was already dead for more than a decade, and ending about 1850. So what we really have is a very carefully constructed hybrid. And I don't know. Have you ever seen a three-dimensional film, Chris? Have you ever gone into one of those cinemas where you put those glasses on? You know this.
I haven't actually. I've seen it at home, and but I know what you mean.
These were.
What angle you look at it, really, isn't it?
Well, the strange thing about three-dimensional glasses is that one of the lenses is a rather blue color, and the other one is red, and somehow the brain. Gets hold of both these signals and it forms what we think of as a three-dimensional image. And this is the optical illusion we call 3D. Now, Mozart is such an omnipresent reality that we think, how can anyone possibly question the life, career, and achievements of this composer? Well, let's start with the beginning, that the biographical or the historical Mozart and the one that we are the story we are familiar with from biographies, film, etc., are two different parts, components of the transcendental image that we consume in our textbooks and on film and on television and in the media and in the concert hall today. Now that doesn't begin to explain Mozart's music, and I'll get into that, of course. But what I'm saying is that if we can consider the posthumous Mozart, and then the Mozart of reality of his actual life, these are two different things, and they have been skillfully welded together. For what purpose? Well, control, I think, is the quickest answer.
Really?
The control of the music industry as we know it. And if you, it's rather like, I don't know if you go to the British Museum recently, Chris, but there's a new Darwin Center down in the British Museum, and there are icons within our culture. Well, take any civilization, ancient Egypt, ancient Babylon, ancient Greece, ancient Rome. All civilizations have their myths.
Yes.
And we subscribe to these myths because they are the conventions of the state. They are the orthodox, sanitized, official Easter Island icons of our civilization. And Mozart just happens to be one of these. Now, it's much more easy to succeed with this control if you can suppress the entire context, the reality of his lifetime. And therefore, I don't know if your listeners have time, go to a library sometime, go to the reference section of the library and check out a big reference book like the Grove Dictionary of Music and Musicians. In English, this is the authoritative journal or the authoritative reference source for the lives and careers of the composers. It's 27 volumes.
Wow.
And 27 volumes of composers. And if you were just to write down, or if you had the time, write down the names of all the composers who lived during Mozart's century, that is the 18th century, from 1700 to 1800, you will come up with something like 3,400 composers. Something like that. Yeah, something like 3,400 composers, of which probably more than half of these wrote operas, concertos, symphonies, masses, sonatas, etc. And of these 3,400 composers, how many of them do we know?
A handful.
The answer is probably less than a handful.
Yeah.
And if we say, well, I confess to my great cultural and musical ignorance on this point, you will have earned a brownie point. But you will not have earned as great a brownie point as the doctors of music in our universities who teach the history of music. If you were to ask them, of the 3,000 or so, 3,400 composers of the 18th century, how many of them do you know in terms of their biography? And they will say, well, I'm a specialist in Venetian opera of the 1720s. And if I persevered and asked them, but of these composers, how many of their biographies have you read? And they will tell you that they probably read about, 20 at most.
Really?
Yeah.
You've been studying this for over 20 years, haven't you?
I have. And the worst of it was that I was as great a consumer of the Mozart myth as everyone else. But there came a time, Chris, when paradoxes and contradictions started to heap up around this character, around the time when I wanted to write a biography myself. That's how enthusiastic I was. And I went to the British Library and I was in touch with Berlin, Germany, Frankfurt, Paris. You name the music library, I was in touch with it. I bothered these people to pieces. I wanted information on a number of things, but I had no reason to suspect that anything would come out of it except an interesting biography. Nothing more than that. I wasn't suspicious of him. I had no reason to suspect that this miracle may not actually be real. But what caused the crisis was when I sat down after some 10 years of making these notes, I had lots of very interesting things, and I had to try to compress these and condense them and make them into a coherent form. And I started coming across anachronisms, contradictions, paradoxes, things I couldn't resolve from my own knowledge. So this set me into a second round of intensive research. This time I was bothering Germans who know about these things in Vienna and you're talking about the National Library of Austria and the Gesellschaft, the music finds in Vienna, and these were the leading experts. Oh, then there was the Mozarteum in Salzburg.
Well, it's an industry, isn't it, really? It's a tourist industry. I mean, you can go up there and you can see, where Mozart lived, etc., etc.
Yes, absolutely. And then you run into the experts or the people who know this subject in great detail. And if you've got the money and the resources and are prepared to pay astronomical sums, you can get these documents for yourself. And I did so. I had a mountain of Mozart literature that people began to suspect they would never see Robert Newman again. He was buried he was buried under a mountain of Mozart literature. Would he ever surface from this?
But I mean, and it must have been a eureka moment when you sort of looked
there was.
Oh, well, hang on a moment. What I've been told and what I've seen, I mean, most of our listeners, including myself, I'm sure you have as well, have seen the film Amadeus that put Mozart on the map in the 1980s in many ways.
Yes.
It looked very feasible. I mean, really, what you're telling everybody is that you're actually revealing a massive fraud.
Yes. But may I describe to you what happened? Because to me, I try to describe what happened. This will not make my story more credible, but it's an honest account of what happened. I couldn't resolve about 3,000 contradictions in the story. And I put it down to my ignorance. Let me say, I'm an ignorant man. I don't claim to...
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
But I am an ignorant man. I was certainly ignorant in these points. And I made a third attempt to try to resolve these with the experts themselves. And really, I gave up at that point. I thought to myself, let me give you just one of the problems. If Mozart, as a young child in Salzburg, was born with such prodigious gifts that he could compose sonatas and play the piano in a wonderful way, etc., and started to compose and emulate his father and all the rest of it, what interest would that have been to anyone whatsoever outside of his home? I mean, can you imagine his father writing to a man in Italy, "My son is playing the piano at the age of 7.
Yes.
What would be your reaction in it? I mean, Italians don't know anything about music, of course. They've never had any pianists in their entire history. They've never written any operas. There's a boy in Salzburg who is writing sonatas. For goodness sake, let's get him across here. We must see this. This is ridiculous. So Leopold Mozart, his father, takes young Wolfgang on a tour, or a series of tours of Europe, which stretched 7 whole years of his childhood. Now, some of them with his older sister. And we are led to believe that the acclaim which followed this wonderful composer was the equivalent of a young child flying a 747 between Miami and London. Because nobody had ever done this before. This was the most amazing thing. The whole of Europe was turning out to see this Mozart. And we have these glowing references of how he... what exactly did he do? The closer you study it, the less certain it becomes. But the story says that he was a prodigy of nature. Nobody had ever seen anything like this in Paris, in Holland, in England, in Germany, in Austria, and finally, of course, in Italy, where he was writing operas before breakfast. Well, maybe not breakfast, but lunchtime. And he was able to... what the Germans called the Wunderkind, the wonder child, this prodigious person. And he followed this up with the most audacious musical feat of all time when he visited Rome with his father, writing down from memory a mass which he heard once in the Vatican. And this prodigious feat was achieved from memory. This is one of the many miracles of the history of music. Mozart is credited with this astounding talent. His actual compositions at this time, and this is by the time he's 12, were virtually zero. But no problem. You're supposed to believe these things because there are lots of people saying them. Now, it doesn't really matter who is saying them. The fact that they happen to be members of the Freemasons and the fraternities is purely incidental. You shouldn't read into this. Mozart, the news traveled like wildfire that there was such a child.
This is a subject I wanted to bring up a little bit later when we cover the later parts of his life. And that is, a lot of people say that there is hidden things, especially in the, is it the Birdcatcher? Secret Masonic symbols. Have you heard any evidence of this?
Oh, yeah. So there is an entire... I'll send you a copy of this book after this. A German writer in 2005 who has analysed Die Zauberflöte, the magic flute, which dates, we are told, from the summer of 1791, 6 months before he died. This is not a Freemasonic opera. People want you to believe that it is. It's not a Freemasonic opera. It is actually a Rosicrucian opera. A Rosicrucian opera and a Freemasonic opera. And also, well, we're not supposed to talk about this, but the Jesuits had some input into this also. It's a fusion of the fraternities. And if you, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but fraternities mattered a great deal during the so-called Enlightenment period.
I mean, did he, are you really saying that he didn't really write anything? It was other ghostwriters that were actually writing this music?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. More than 30 composers were involved in the music that we know today as Mozart. It's not so much an opinion, but a fact that simply is never told to people. Let's take, for example, Mozart's symphonies. There are 50 of these symphonies, 50, depending on who you ask. Officially, there are 41. But if you contact expert B, he will tell you there are more than 50. So somewhere between 41 and 50 symphonies are attributed to Mozart. The first 25, or shall we say the first half of these, the first symphony number 1 to 25, in no less than 8 different publications, musicologists are telling us there is no evidence whatsoever that Mozart actually composed these works. None. But they are by tradition attributed to Mozart. Okay, so because by tradition they're attributed to Mozart, therefore they belong to Mozart. And that's just the symphonies. If you take the piano concertos, there's some beautiful piano concertos attributed to Mozart. I love some of them myself. There are 27 piano concertos attributed or credited to Mozart. But the first 7 of these, the childhood concertos, are not actually by Mozart. And this has been recognized even by the Mozart establishment since the early 20th century, when it was unfortunately discovered that they were based upon their arrangements of music by other composers who were based in Paris. So we can say goodbye to concertos number 1 to 7. That still leaves us with another 20, but I just want to start as I mean to go on. So if we remove the first 25 symphonies, which lack any evidence of being by Mozart, and the first 7 piano concertos, it doesn't really leave us a great deal to talk about as far as his childhood compositions are concerned. And so this elaborate system of praising this wonder child had to be invented to compensate for the reality. And so that was the childhood. It wasn't until he was about 12 years of age that the music profession finally caught up with Mr. Mozart and his father in Vienna. And the year was 1768. In 1768, he came back from these tours that he had taken, believing that the whole of Vienna would believe in his reputation. Well, many did, but the only ones who didn't were musicians themselves. Musicians knew from the very start that this was an elaborate fraud, and they were not afraid to say so. Vienna was full of people laughing at this. This was the most outrageous. Why are you doing this to your son? He has never spent a day in school in his life. He has never studied music. Under which teacher has your son ever learned composition? This is what the musicians were asking Mozart's father. His father was so upset with this that he obtained an audience with the emperor in Vienna at that time, and Maria Theresa, and saying, I'm being insulted, me and my son, it's terrible. And I really think it's very unfair. We've been all around Europe. I have all these glowing references. And the musicians don't trust us. They don't like my son. They're obviously prejudiced against his genius. So the result of this, and this is documented, the result of this meeting was that young Wolfgang obtained a commission to write an opera for the next season in Vienna. That's 1769, which was then ghost-written for Mozart and brought back to the Austrian capital, ready for its premiere. Well, there was only a small problem. The small problem was that the manager of the opera and the musicians could quickly see that this child had not written this music at all. This was the music of others. And they were not afraid to say so. And they did so. They did say so.
Now, I believe you've got evidence, because I've actually seen on the internet, I think it's on your site, where you see Mozart's signature, and underneath, there's somebody else's signature.
Yes, that's one of about 20 cases. The document you are looking at comes from Symphony No. 31, the Paris Symphony, which comes from 1778. This has been attributed to Mozart. It was never published in his life. In fact, to be honest, most of Mozart's music was published long after his death. So, really? Yeah.
What connections did his father have to get his son on? I mean, he must have been very well connected.
Yeah, exactly. Great question. Leopold Mozart was a member of an occultist fraternity. He came from a place called Augsburg. Augsburg in Germany was the center for a lot of commerce with the emerging British Empire. And Augsburg had close links to the occultists of Venice. Venice was where much of the opera came from, of course.
Well, the plot thickens, doesn't it? I mean, this is interesting. Wow, I mean...
Yes. Well, if you look at the history of Leopold Mozart was a... he became a Leopold, his father, became a violinist only incidentally. In those days, working class people could, you know, they could play in the orchestra in the position of fourth violinist, which is, you know, there's fourth, third, second, the first violin part has the most difficult, but anyway, you could be a valet, and he was a valet. You could be a valet and a fourth violinist, and that's what Leopold Mozart was. He, however, had very close links with the fraternities who were starting to control music as an industry. Music at that time was not an industry, but it had aspirations to become an international industry across the Holy Roman Empire.
So who was making the money? I mean, obviously Leopold was, but I mean, who was the, shall we say, in modern terms, the managers, the manipulators, the people that... shall we say, push the myth? My attitude is always follow the trail of money, and you find out.
Yeah, that's hard. Well, partly true. In the early days, it was the Holy Roman Empire. You must remember that Austria at this time, you're talking about the 1760s, 1770s, 1780s, Austria militarily was humbled, beaten, defeated on the field of battle over and over and over again throughout the 18th century. Its status was in decline, and in decline also was the whole idea of the Holy Roman Empire. The Jesuits, who had controlled the academic world, they controlled all universities. They controlled publishing. All books in the Holy Roman Empire, all the way from Spain to the Russian border, were controlled by the Jesuit order, who were the teachers of the Holy Roman Empire. All universities, all colleges, all music colleges was under the control of that one organization, who were controlling the counter-reformation. So, you know, the Protestants had their reformation, but Rome had its counter-reformation. The counter-reformation was cultural also. There was a big program of painting churches, commissioning music, festivals, etc., etc. This was a big deal. So the propaganda on both sides, Reformation and Counter-Reformation, was the reality of the situation into which Mozart was born. In Salzburg, his hometown, in 1730, you can see this for yourself in the pages of history, the entire population of Salzburg was evicted from the city if they couldn't prove that they were baptized, officially approved Roman Catholics. More than 40,000 of them were evicted in 1730. They were given 4 days' notice, and they were told to leave the city. Why? Why? Why was this?
Well, I'm going to focus on here.
One of the largest evictions of human people of the 18th century, and this was happening right in Mozart's birthplace. The religious dogmatism had not died. It wasn't just the 16th century or 7th. This is in the 18th century, 20 years before Mozart's birth. This is the true context within which Austria or Austria-Hungary, the empire, wanted badly some heroic figures, some achievers, something that they could credit to their civilization. They needed these things extremely badly. And what better way than to make Vienna the city of music? It's a title it has today. And then out of Vienna comes not only Mozart, Haydn, and later Beethoven. These giant figures are living proof, we believe, of the genius of Austria-Hungary, of the Holy Roman Empire, every single one of which has their own story. But in order to produce these iconic figures, you would literally have to rewrite history. You would have to forget the life and careers of 3,000 composers. You would never hear of them anymore. They would never be performed. Even those in Vienna. If you look at the last 10 years of Mozart's life, 1781 to 1791, how many composers living in Vienna at that time, how much of their music have we heard?
Zilch.
Zilch. None. Well, hang on a minute. If I name a few names, I could mention, I say 100. Let me just give 4 or 5. Van Hal, Gazzaniga, Sarti, Salieri, etc. These people were putting on opera after opera after opera. And this is the history of Viennese music, 1780 to 1790. And you will not find any recordings of their music. None.
But I'd never heard of them. I mean,
well, these are the dominant composers in Vienna. Forget Germany, just talk about Vienna, where Mozart is living. I mean, this is the amnesia. This is the control which has come into music. Now, this is only a small part of the story, because we must also explain, how did this music come into being? If he didn't write it, who did? And how could they possibly have got away with this?
That's right. I mean, are you really saying that he never really wrote anything?
Mozart wrote about half a dozen works in his entire life.
Really?
Yeah.
I've done a wrong writer. I've done a writer. He didn't write anything. I didn't think.
Half a dozen works in his entire life. Choose a piece. You know Mozart, Chris.
This is one of my favourites.
The Jupiter Symphony, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, the Jupiter Symphony is the last credited symphony of Mozart, and it was written, you know this, it was written in the summer of 1788. It was one of three symphonies which he tossed off in a matter of 6 weeks. And if you believe that, you believe anything.
Six weeks?
Oh, yes. Yes. So, symphony number 39 in E-flat, number 40, the G minor, and 41, the Jupiter Symphony, were supposedly written by Mozart in 3 weeks of 1788. There's about 3,000 problems with that, but let's just mention a few. the Jupiter Symphony was never performed during Mozart's lifetime, which is unusual. Why would he write these symphonies? Is there any record of him trying to have them published? No, there's not. When were these works published? They were first published about 23 years after his death. We are in fantasy land, but it's not just with Symphony Number 41, the Jupiter. It also, let's take the mature symphonies of Mozart. Let's take, for example, let's take Number 31, the Paris Symphony, the one you've seen the signature for. With Lucchesi's signature has been overwritten by that of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. The Paris Symphony has a strange history. It was supposedly written by Mozart for Paris, for a performance in Paris. However, it exists in two different versions, and they don't tell you that also. The Paris Symphony it dates from 1778, and actually, it's on paper, which comes from Mannheim. It doesn't come from Paris at all. It was sent to Mozart, and it was performed in his name. Indeed, it was published 6 months later in Paris, in yet another different version. If you go today to Italy, to a place called Modena, in Modena there is a music library. The music library of Modena, and it has amongst its music scores some symphonies which are attributed to Mozart. There are 10 of them, and they're very early versions. Now, it's a strange coincidence that the textbooks who talk about Mozart never mention these strange musical scores which of Mozart symphonies in Modena, in the Estense Library of Modena. Why don't they mention them? Well, the reason they don't mention them... there are thousands of reasons. One of the reasons is that the scoring, that is to say the orchestra, you know, which instruments are playing, and is completely different from the version we know today. It's an earlier version. Not only this, but these versions are written on Italian paper, many of them, on Italian paper, and it doesn't come from Germany, Austria at all. We're talking here about 10 of Mozart's, inverted commas, his symphony. Attempts to have these very important documents published have included letters to the editor of the Mozart catalogue, which is published every 10 or 20 years, without any reply at all. Several musicologists in Italy have attempted to do this. No reply at all. None.
That doesn't surprise me, but I mean, none. There's also a bit of mystery, or a lot of mystery, surrounding Mozart's death.
Ah, yes.
Was he? Did he die, or was he pushed? Was he Dr. Kellidge, shall we say?
The evidence, such as it is, suggests that he was poisoned.
That's what they said. That's what was put over in the film, wasn't it?
But there are a number of things about Mozart's final years which are extremely strange. They had to create this character was relatively easy, but what was not easy was to have a body of music which could be attributed to him. And this was only relatively successful during his lifetime. Of the 700 works of Mozart, 140 of these were actually published in his lifetime. So that leaves us 556, which appeared suddenly in a torrent within 20 years of his death. Now, that's unusual to start with. Well, maybe it's, you might say, well, maybe he just wasn't recognized. Well, you can't have it both ways. Either Mozart was a highly celebrated genius composer in Vienna, or he was not. Either he died in poverty and indifference, or he did not. But the Mozart industry wants to have it both ways. Mozart, they say, was a hugely recognized composer across Europe. He was admired everywhere he went. He was a musical genius. He could perform piano concertos himself in Vienna, and he was an acknowledged maestro on the piano. Well, no, he wasn't. If you look at the actual documents of the time, the newspapers and the reports, they don't say any such thing. In fact, the librettist for five of his operas in Vienna, Die Entführung aus dem Serail was the first opera, The Abduction from the Seraglio, 1782. People present at the premiere in their diary said, this opera has music that is not by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. I mean, these are diary records of the time. This is 1782.
He's not left any stone unturned.
But we've come to even more amazing things. Then you have The Marriage of Figaro. Well, surely this is one of the most wonderful operas in the whole of Western music. Mozart definitely wrote this because we have playbills for this. Surely he had to compose this music. Are you saying that Mozart didn't write The Marriage of Figaro? What are you saying? Well, okay, let's see if Mozart really did write The Marriage of Figaro. And how are you going to do that? Well, how about checking the music itself? And they will say, yes, of course, Robert. We will show you the autograph score of The Marriage of Figaro. Here it is. We are selling it online. And you can check it for yourself, Chris. You can buy a copy of the autograph of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's Le Nozze di Figaro. And you think, that is marvellous. Look at that. His own handwriting. It's marvellous. There's the corrections he made in his own handwriting. And you can buy this from the Packard Institute.
Really?
Packard Institute are selling the autograph score of not only The Marriage of Figaro, but Don Giovanni and all the rest. And you think, there you are, Robert. You and your friends have been proved wrong. There is the documentary evidence. Well, no, not exactly. Why not? Well, first of all, The Marriage of Figaro was premiered in Vienna on the 1st of May, 1786. That autograph, inverted commas, is not actually an autograph. And they will say, what do you mean? Of course it's an autograph. No, it's not an autograph. Well, what evidence do you have that is not an autograph? And I will say, or we will say to them, look on page one. Do you see the Italian text there? They will say, yes. Do you see the German text on the bottom? Oh, yes, there's a German text there. Yes, but that German text wasn't written for another 20 years. And so it's not really an autograph, is it? It's a copy that was made 20 years later. And they'll say, well, but he still wrote the music. And how about this? Let's go to the National Library of Austria in Vienna. And let's ask them to show us the actual music that was performed in Vienna on the 1st of May, 1786, in the name of Mozart. Now, there's a strange thing coming here, that the Mozart industry has never shown you this manuscript. Why don't they show us this manuscript? In 200 years of Mozart study, surely they must have published some articles on this particular piece of music. No, they haven't. They will show you the autograph, so-called autograph. Now, two Italian musicians who knew about this traveled to Vienna 4 years ago, Chris.
Yeah.
And they paid a big sum of money to do what? To chase down the actual manuscript of The Marriage of Figaro, the theatre copy, the actual copy used for the rehearsals and first performance of this opera, which was divided into two parts and kept in different parts of the library. Strange, but it became very difficult. But after about 4 days, they finally managed to get an agreement that they could take photocopies or microfiches of this document. They didn't like it. They didn't expect it. And they certainly didn't expect these Italians to have the money to pay for these because they're rather expensive. You can imagine. It's an industry. Yeah. So what they did is they got the camera set up and they started photographing page after page of the opera that was performed at the premiere of this Marriage of Figaro. And they took it back to Italy. No sooner had they published this, the contents of this document, than there was a huge series of complaints that they had stolen this manuscript. They had no permission to use this. They shouldn't have done. And now all of this raged for about 4 months, while the Italians, who were experts in 18th century opera, analyzed the music within what they had just photographed. And what they discovered was this, that this music was actually an arrangement in the Italian language of music that already existed in the German language. And we know this because the Italian didn't fit the music. It was a clumsy fit. Yeah? It had recently been translated into the Italian language for Vienna by Lorenzo da Ponte. So what they had really done, cleverly, was to create an arrangement which would be credited to Mozart, although the opera itself was not by Mozart. In fact, the music is full of mistakes. Full of mistakes. So embarrassing that the Mozart industry have never spoken about it ever since. Not before and not since. And that's just one example. Just one example. A classic example. They will tell you they have the documentary evidence. Fine. Okay, let's look at the documentary evidence. And the result of this, just this one incident, when the opera was performed in May of 1786, it was hissed and booed so loudly that it was withdrawn from Vienna after only 6 performances. But you don't hear that also in the textbooks.
So, I mean, it's really, it is selective history. And what I mean, what I've found, I mean, my particular interest is the 20th century and 19th century and the wars and how they were created. Now, I'm not changing the subject or anything like that.
No.
And what I've noticed is that you've got what I call the armchair historians, the establishment ones, who look for all the official records and interpret it. They have their own sort of particular interpretation of what they've read. They don't go behind and speak to the actual people.
Yes.
And do what a good historian such as yourself does, look through the diaries, look at what was happening at the time, because you'll see a very, very different story. And I always say there's the official version and there's the true version of what happened.
Of course.
Let's face it, people in power only tell you what they want you to know, not necessarily the truth.
Oh, yeah, this is so true. This is so true. And this is what an icon, a cultural icon, does. A cultural icon becomes a transcendental figure, like an inflatable balloon. He dominates the landscape to the point where our education consists of a handful of icons which have been pre-selected for us by those who make the value judgments. They write the biographies, they write the histories, and the official version, as you say, with World War II or World War I, they write the official story, and anyone who challenges the official story, because the official story is Dr. Such and Such is quoting Dr. Such and Such, he's also quoting Dr. Such and Such, and he quotes Dr. Such and Such, and it goes on like this.
Well, it's always the lapel grasping brigade who sort of look skywards. You know, whenever you see pictures of war and that, when there's a hero, they're always grasping their lapel and looking skyward, and that's a sort of, I mean, it's like World War II during the Battle of Britain, for example. They said, the Spitfire saved the day. A lot of pilots refused to fly the Spitfire. They hated it. They preferred the Hurricane.
Really?
And during World War II, during the Battle of Britain, not that many squadrons had Spitfires. It was really the Hurricane that saved the day. But
really?
What it really was a morale booster, because Churchill could say, we've got this super weapon, the Spitfire, you know, it does this, that and the other. Well, a hurricane could take much more punishment and could be patched up and be in the air the next day. But a Spitfire, yes, off to the metal bashers to actually have, you know, the plates restored if it got shot up. But I diverted. Let's go back to boats.
No. I was going to ask you about that. It raises the interesting point. Since Winston Churchill went on to become one of the leading advocates for the European experiment, is there any evidence that during his lifetime he was as pro-European during World War II as he was after World War II?
Well, is there any? He contradicted himself throughout his life. I mean, he changed parties umpteen times, and there is evidence, yes, that he was pro-European. But I mean, he is a man of many contradictions, and I'm afraid he's not on my hero list. He, I think, was probably, a lot of the older people say, oh, yes, he took us through World War II. Oh, Winnie did marvellous speeches. Well, there's a lot of evidence that he didn't actually do the speeches. It was an actor that did it. And
yes.
So drunk. And he was really an image man. And how he got into Parliament, there is evidence that he was fiddled in. I could go on and on about.
No.
But it wasn't exactly as popular as they like to make out.
So, yeah, music being such a force for culture, people got tired of generals and battles, and so they wanted something that, you know, that was a bit more positive. And besides, Italy, the Italians dominated the music scene in the 18th century.
Glenn Miller in Second World War.
Yeah.
That was a musical, hey, you know, we're going to beat the Huns. Well, not Huns, the Germans or Nazis, as I was known then. Yeah, sorry, I interrupted just then. But
you're right.
Thing.
You're right. The cultural, who would suspect that the heroes of our culture are as manufactured as the politicians? Or the bankers, or the broadcasters, or every that. Of course, there is an industry, and when money gets involved, it tends to change things.
Yeah.
This is
social engineering, isn't it? Really,
yes.
It really boils down to.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like when I was at school, teacher would come in. I remember this quite clearly, and the teacher would say, "Right. Who built Stonehenge?" You'd stick your hand up and you'd say, "It's the Druids, miss." And I'd say, "First class, yes." Well, the Druids were around 1,000 years after it was built. They used it. In the 60s, that was believed.
And yeah.
We're changing our view all the time.
Absolutely.
I mean, I remember we was talking off air, and I know I'm changing the subject slightly here, but I'm going to mention a day which will probably get you firing off in all cylinders, Einstein.
Oh, yes. Mr. Einstein. Yes. Mr. Einstein. Yeah, you were right to predict my reaction. But, there are certain things that we subscribe to, and we believe that these people have these prodigious gifts, and they were genius. I mean, the archetypal genius is Albert Einstein. Well, if it's not Albert Einstein, it's Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. I mean, and nobody ever defines what genius means. We just attach this label to these people, and they are geniuses. Everybody knows that Albert Einstein was a genius.
Something a little bit different.
Yeah. No, if you ask, well, would you mind me asking what exactly you mean by the word genius? Well, you know what genius means. It means so clever that nobody can understand them. Mm. Or at least these individuals who are capable of doing transcendentally marvelous things with the minimum of ease, or something like this. Or they're members of Mensa, perhaps. or they may have joined the right fraternity, but we won't get into that. Or
it's having the right connections, isn't it, most of the time? Yeah, it's not what you know, but who you know. And that's from the year dot, that's always been the case, isn't
absolutely
it?
And then, of course, there are the Manchurian candidates, those who become prominent when there is favour to be won, and those who fulfil certain cultural functions. You can extend that to the BBC or you know, the corporate world in which we live. These personalities, yeah, who are made into images, and these images, in a sense, much of what we think today comes from a thinking when the church used to rule Western society and it finally relaxed its grip upon the people. That period, which was as engineered as the period before it, gave us the impression of an individualism, which is such a striking feature of Western civilization as a whole. The individualism, or the sovereignty of the individual. There's no trait more obvious about Western civilization than its individualism. And it's one of the striking... you could almost define Western civilization by its high level of individualism, because a man can differ with everybody else and become an eccentric, and he is known as an individualist, and we highly value this individualism. This is seen as eccentricity by everybody else, but we love this. We think this is marvelous, and therefore Albert Einstein, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Now, if you look at this individualism, it comes from the Enlightenment period. In other words, a man can differ from the norm, provided that he is ultimately controlled by the same people who are controlling the society before it. Therefore, a statue of Mozart can stand next to the Emperor of Austria. And we don't see the contradiction in this. We think that Mozart is an individual. He's one of the first independent composers, and he broke away from the church, and he's marvelous. Well, they don't tell you, of course, that Mozart was employed by the church up until the time that he supposedly broke away from it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Mozart was in the employment of the Archbishop of Salzburg up until 1781. And after his break, inverted commas, he remained under the control of the Archbishop of Salzburg, and then came into the care of the British Empire. The British Empire. And the reason why the British
Empire... British Empire? Now, I can't see the connection. Can you sort of clarify that with me? I'm sorry.
Okay. The British Empire... The reason the British Empire got involved in Mozart is the same reason that the British Empire got involved in the career of George Frederick Handel. Handel, as you know, was a German composer who was based in London at the beginning of the Hanoverian dynasty. Yeah, mm-hmm. When Germany and England nominally were united. And what better way to unite these two great Protestant countries than George Frederick Handel? But George Frederick Handel was as much of a counterfeit as Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was. Because, I'm sorry, but I have to say this, George Frederick Handel lived half of his early life in Rome. He was feted by the cardinals of Rome, etc. This is a strange thing for a Lutheran to be doing, but he did this, and his first seven operas are not by Handel in the first place. But it was very good public relations that when Hanover took over England and started to rule George the First, that Handel took up residence in England, and all these marvelous operas brought glory to what? To the British Empire. The British Empire through the East India Company were financing Germany, or Hanover at least, for over 75 years before Mozart was born. Hanover, the House of Hanover, or Northern Germany. They depended on the money coming from the East India Company. There's documents in the British Library that say exactly that. You can see these, it's all historical fact.
Well, the Queen is German, isn't she?
Well, yeah. This is where the link comes from. The Hanoverian dynasty changed everything, and Britain, or rather the elites of Britain, were financing large parts of Germany. George III was the treasurer of the Holy Roman Empire, which is unusual since he was a Protestant king. But we won't get into that. The hypocrisy involved in monarchy is almost as great as politics or anything else.
Well, with the passage of time, though, I mean, it's too easy to actually alter history. I mean, I know I keep going back to the Second World War, but that's my particular subject. I've noticed that as the generation of the Second World War is now passing away, the history, even though it's well documented and probably one of the best documented wars, is also starting to get manipulated,
really?
Altered and changed and viewed by a modern generation.
Really?
Totally different to the way it was then.
Really?
And, oh, crumbs, yes. There's a heck of a lot of, you speak to a young person. I was speaking to somebody at a radio station once, and she's just out of university, and I was helping to promote my father's book. And she thought that the young men in 1939 were falling over themselves to sign up to go to war. My dad said, no, the opposite was that.
Really?
Who the hell would want to go and volunteer, go and get their brains blown out? Like you always had the keen ones and the loonies and the people that believe everything they're told. And there's people that obviously want action. But the average person, I mean, if somebody went up to you and said, excuse me, can you sign on the dotted line? And if you sign here, what we'll do, you can have a life of poverty, you might get your arms or legs blown up, and you'll be psychologically ruined for life. So if you just like to sign it, so no, I don't think it's a very good deal, thank you very much.
How did they actually, in the light of the First World War, how did they convince large numbers of British people to sign up in the first place?
They didn't. They brought in conscription. They didn't have a choice.
Well, when did they do that?
They brought in conscription in 1939.
Oh, right.
And it was obviously propaganda because, the newspapers hype it up all the time. And they said the usual old, bovine excrement, that the vast majority of the population wanted to introduce conscription because we're under threat from Adolf Hitler, which at that time we weren't under any threat from Adolf Hitler.
Oh.
And in 1939, they started conscripting 19 and 20-year-olds.
Well, before they declared war?
They started before they declared war, because they knew that war was almost imminent, really. September the 3rd, war began, it started, conscription, it was on the statute books long before then.
Really? I didn't know that.
Because they knew there was a war imminent. But what the papers did report, but not showing on the headlines, was that a lot of chaps that got conscripted committed suicide, and the suicide rate amongst 20-year-olds was phenomenally high. But you won't find that in the history books, because what you'll find in the official history books is, the young men were keen to sign up, and when they got their papers through, they all were jolly happy to go along and
do
their bit for the country. Well, the facts are not quite like that, because, let's face it, what normal human being wants to go and get his brains blown out?
No. Oh, I had no idea. I'm trying to relate the events in Poland with justifying a British call-up is quite amazing in itself, no?
Well, it's because it was really an excuse to get involved because we had a similar arrangement. I believe, now I could be wrong, I think it was Tibet. There was a country that was invaded by China in 1964.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it was Tibet. And we had a similar pact
with
that country. But we did the square root and nothing about it because it wasn't in our interests. And it wasn't in our interests then, and it's still a mystery why we got involved in World War II, because it's about the only war where the so-called enemy was going away from us and not towards us. Like somebody coming in and saying, I'm not going to hurt you, I'm walking away, and you say, I'm going to declare war on you because you're a threat and you're walking away. It doesn't make sense, does it?
Yes. Well, so this strangeness is the same in your area of study as it is in mine. And but joining up the dots is sometimes good fun, and you reach a point where you only really know your subject when you're able to predict how it's going to act in the future, yeah? And then you say, oh yeah, now I understand it. And sure enough, Mozart comes along after the marriage of Figaro and he produces Così fan tutti. Oh, Così fan tutti surely has to be a Mozart. Oh, no, it's not. And then we come to the marvelous last period of Mozart's life when he writes The Magic Flute. Surely this has to be by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Please don't tell me, Robert, that this is not by Mozart also. Well, I'm sorry to say this, but it isn't by Mozart. Oh, Robert, surely, how can you disagree with 200 years of musical expertise? This is taking you beyond. What credibility, what evidence do you have that this is not by Mozart? Well, my answer is this. The Magic Flute was premiered in Vienna in the summer of 1791. Did you know the name of the opera that was staged in the same theater before it was premiered? And they say, well, no, I've never. Oh, well, okay. Have you heard of a composer by the name of Paul Ranitsky? And they will say, no, I've never heard of Paul Ranitsky. Well, you should have heard of Paul Ranitsky. They say, why? Well, Paul Ranitsky was the most popular composer of operas in Vienna during the 10 years Mozart was living there. Oh, well, I didn't know that. Have you ever heard any music of Paul Ranitsky? No, I've never heard any music of Paul Ranitsky. Oh, that's strange. They'll say, why is it strange? And I will say it's strange because Paul Ranitsky was a good friend of Mozart. Oh, I've never heard of him. Oh, okay then. Let me show you one piece of music by Paul Ranitsky. And they'll say, okay, show me one piece. How about the opera Oberon? O-B-E-R-O-N, Oberon. Have you ever heard this opera? They say, no, I've never heard of Ranitsky's Oberon. Why are you showing this to me? Well, you might notice about 50 different quotations from this opera in Mozart's Magic Flute of 6 months later. They'll say, no, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Well, get the music score of Paul Ranitsky's Oberon and listen to it for yourself. But this has to be spirited away from any knowledge of the general public. And therefore, Paul Ranitsky never existed. And nor did Van Hal, nor did Gazzaniga, nor did Lucchese, nor did 65 other composers. They must be politely put to one side and let us build instead the Easter Island, Vienna, the city of music. So we roughly arrived at halfway through our discussion on Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
It's a bit like the Korea, the Crimean War. We hear about the lady with the lamp, Florence Nightingale.
Oh yes.
But there was another woman that was in Ducal. You never hear about really? Her. And Florence Nightingale, this woman Ducal, she was dynamic. But you never hear about her. She was written out of history. And Florence Nightingale, really? The lady with the lamp, was this, beautiful. Well, apparently, okay, she was a nurse, she nursed soldiers. But this, I can't remember her first name. I know her surname is Ducal. This other woman, self-financed, going to the Crimean War. And she was very loving and kind. And she used herbal remedies to cure the troops. And she saved loads of lives, but she was written out of history. People have never heard of her, but it's always the lady with the lamp who was a bit off-handed and very cold, and there is reason to believe that, shall we say, she wasn't that keen on men.
All right.
I'll try to be politically correct here. There may be children listening.
Yes. In order to achieve the total takeover of a society, takes centuries. And one of the ways in which it's done, as everybody knows, is the media, or at least the academic world. And if you can invent an industry which is controlled from the very beginning, and who can write books on the history of music, which they started to do in about 1800. Nobody had written books on the history of, nobody had attempted such a thing until around 1800, 10 years after Mozart died. And then came a series of books on the history of music in glowing terms describing Wolfgang Amadeus, blah, 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 Mozart, blah, Mozart. Now, before you know it, Mozart is the dominant character being performed all across Europe. Isn't it marvelous? Isn't it wonderful? This amazing, sensational genius. And also Joseph Haydn, of course. This is another Manchurian.
Sorry to cut across you, Robert. I do apologise, but we're coming up to a break now. If we could discuss this after the break.
Yeah.
Great. So stay tuned and join us after the break.